Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 24 for July 19th, 2009. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm very happy to have you with me, as always. It's nice to be back doing another podcast. Took a little time off, a little summer break, I guess you could say, for the podcast. And typically, I put these out every month, but I kind of skipped the month of June. So here I am in July, but I'm back with a vengeance. I've got a great podcast lined up for you. I really think you're going to enjoy it. This episode features an interview with Clint Hocking. Clint needs no introduction, I would imagine, to most of you listening to this podcast, and it's a real treat for me to have him on. Clint is the creative director at Ubisoft Montreal. I sort of properly introduce him in the segment, so I won't rehash it here, but needless to say, Clint is well-known to many of you and greatly admired by many of us. I really enjoyed the interview, and I hope you will too. So that's segment one. And then in segment two, I invited a couple of other designers to join me, and we sort of get down to business and talk about game design. And for that segment, I invited Manveer Hare from Raven Software, a frequent guest on this show, a good friend, and also Borut Pfeiffer from EA LA, a guest who was supposed to be on the previous podcast, but due to some technical difficulties, we were unable to work that out. So I'm glad to have Borut back on the show. Borut writes The Plush Apocalypse, which is a blog I would highly recommend to you. And of course, Manveer writes the Design Rampage blog, which I've spoken about and written about before. Highly recommended as well. So that's the show. I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another edition of the Gamers Confab. As you'll see, I think it's going to be a Gamers Confab blowout. I'm working on multiple segments of that, and there are some folks who have been in the confab before, and I'm looking forward to chatting with them again. It's been a while, and I may even bring some new people into the confab, and that's, like I said, in a couple weeks. So I hope you enjoy the show, and away we go. It is my great pleasure to welcome Clint Hocking to the podcast. Clint is the creative director at Ubisoft Montreal, where he worked as a level designer and a script writer for Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell. He also served in those same functions for Splinter Cell Chaos Theory. And more recently, he was the creative director for Far Cry 2. Clint's presentations on design at the Game Developers Conference are regularly among the most high-rated by attendees. He has also spoken at other settings like the Austin Game Writing Conference and Future Play. He maintains a blog called Click Nothing, where he periodically discusses issues related to game design and other things. And that's the place where Clint coins phrases like ludonarrative dissonance, which have become part of the games criticism lexicon. I think it's no stretch at all to describe Clint as the most visible, I think, in my view, the most articulate proponent of games as an art form and a powerful medium with great untapped potential. Clint, it's a great, great pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining me, and welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast.
I'm very happy to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Great. Well, we'll begin by talking about you. Manveer Hare and Borut Pfeiffer will join us in a little while to talk a bit about game design, but I'm curious a little bit about your background.
Okay.
When did you first become interested in games? Might be a good place to start.
Wow. I mean, I remember playing an Atari 2600 at my when I was 7 or 8 years old, I guess. But I mean, really, I started playing most with games on a VIC-20. So I guess I was a PC gamer in the beginning on a VIC-20 when I was 12 or 13. I learned a little bit of BASIC and was making games in BASIC back then. And it was actually a really good system, even though it was a pretty crappy PC. It had you know, really good cartridges, and there were a lot of pretty impressive games on that system. I remember playing Load Runner, and they had a level editor that allowed you to build your own Load Runner maps, and it was amazing. I must have built 100 or 200 maps for Load Runner, and you could save them on cassette. I mean, that was the storage media of the era, right? Saving Load Runner maps on cassette, right, and having to like fast forward through the little counter on the cassette, you know, to get the counter lined up to where your map would load, and then loading your maps. So, I mean, yeah, it's been a long time.
What is it that clicks for a person who's playing a game that sort of says, I want to make a game? For you, how did you make that transition between enjoying the playing of games to wanting to get creative with the level editors and stuff?
I've always likened level design and to a lesser extent game design to being like picking the white glue off of the top of the Elmer's glue bottle and like trying to get the little bits of glue to unclog the glue. I don't know why. When I was little, it's like this obsessive compulsive thing, right? When I was little, it was like, I remember being fascinated by trying to unplug the glue containers in art class in elementary school and having the same sort of, neurochemical stimulation from trying to build a map. It's just like being able to fixate on something really minute and refine it, I think it just stimulates something inside my lizard brain somewhere or something. I don't know.
Did your parents encourage you?
Well, I mean, my mom was paying for those consoles and games and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, to a certain extent, I mean, she never really understood what I was doing. I mean, she played my first games on VIC-20, but, you know, needless to say, there wasn't much there. So it wasn't very, very much to encourage, but I mean, yeah, she definitely, made sure I had the tools to keep working, that's for sure.
Yeah. Did you share them then with friends? Were there other people you knew that were sort of up to the same thing, or were you kind of on your own?
No, I was mostly on my own. I mean, I remember, like I said, I was like the PC guy, right? So I had my VIC-20 and you know, my friends across the way had ColecoVisions and and Intellivisions and stuff. So it was really hard to sell your friends on your really mediocre text adventure when they were playing, you know, I mean, they were playing Super Mario Brothers, right? It's like, forget Miyamoto, you should come and check out my crappy text adventure on VIC-20. I mean, the competition was pretty extreme. So I was a little bit on my own with my PC games.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of student were you in school?
Well, I was the kind that wasn't in school. I remember through the back half of, especially through the back half of high school, my attendance was abysmal. It's a miracle they didn't just fail me out of every single course. I just didn't go. I mean, I think that was back in the day when you could actually get away with that. I hear that's not the case now, but I mean, I was literally never there, so.
Yeah, fast. Well, do you find this to be the case when you talk to other designers? I mean, you've certainly know way more than I do, but the ones that I've spoken to often feel... Well, and Jim G's spoken about this, that game designers are often really creative people who just really didn't fit in school.
I think that's true, certainly among the game designers I know. Or I mean, it reminds me of, you know, what I talked about in my talk about, you know, Generation X and Generation Y. I think it's definitely true that at least Generation X game designers were really kind of and you get it, it's exactly that, you know, we were kind of on the outside fringes when we were kids because we weren't the ones playing, you know, Super Mario on ColecoVision. We were the ones making our own games on our C64s. Maybe that led to us having a kind of a DIY attitude, kind of being a little bit outsiders, kind of like teaching ourselves, kind of having trouble in school, whether that was like trouble as in like success trouble or whether it was trouble as in legal trouble or whatever. But I mean, I think we were kind of a little bit outside. I don't know if that's the case anymore. I certainly, you know, certainly the kids I see coming into game development now. I mean, I remember even when I started back in 2000, I mean, I was working with at least a few people who hadn't even graduated from high school. Now it's like, I mean, these people have degrees in game development, so it's a different world.
Yeah. At some point though, something lit a fire in you to continue with school. You went to grad school, you got an MFA in creative writing. What happened?
I mean, I think it wasn't until after I got out of high school that I realized I actually liked school, right? And you know, I don't mean that as a dig against my high school or against my high school teachers or anything like that. It's just it didn't work for me when it was like being in the army. Once I had the freedom to sort of decide what I wanted to do and make choices about, you know, my education and about my curriculum, you know, I was able to find the things I was interested in and focus on them. I wasn't forced to do PE with a physical ed instructor who was actually a math teacher, right? I mean, that was a weird setup. And you know, once I started taking creative writing courses from people who were passionate about both writing and teaching, like, it really changes your perspective on what education is, right?
When you were studying creative writing, did you have any idea at that time that you might want to write for games or create games or anything? Was there a connection in your mind at that point?
No, there wasn't really a connection, but looking back on it now, it's really apparent that, you know, I was particularly interested in one instructor, George McWhorter out of University of British Columbia. And he taught what he called an experimental fiction course. And I took that course a couple times and he ended up being my thesis advisor and all of that. But really he was pushing for people to do really wild stuff. And I always felt constrained by the medium of writing, right? I always felt like the idea of writing a novel from front to back was really, kind of archaic. And so my writing was really experimental on that front, trying to do different things, trying to shatter perspectives and, you know, make stories that weren't sort of these, well, to start throwing around the heavy words, sort of like centrally top down, you know, authored. I mean, of course, all writing is authored, but I wanted to break that, right? And it was obviously creative writing is not the best medium to be working in if you're trying to break the idea of authorship. So, I mean, I didn't really understand it at the time, but it seems obvious now.
Yeah. So the whole question of authorship, which we'll get to a bit more in detail with Manveer and Borut, but I'm interested in how that sort of morphed for you away from what's obviously a kind of single inspired author writing a novel or a short story. That's sort of where you started. What was it about that that seemed to not fit for you, or that seemed that it wasn't quite giving you what you wanted?
The whole concept of writing a linear story to me seems very artificial, and I don't mean that as in fake. I mean it as in artifice. I mean it as in crafted with a very strong intent, which to me feels like there's a certain amount of dishonesty in that, right? We don't craft our life experience. Our life experience isn't manufactured for us to experience in a particular way, right? Our life experience and what we are is very, very improvisational and very made up as you go. And it's very subject to chance, and it's very subject to our subjective opinion and perspective on what's going on. So, I mean, for me, it was very hard to say honest things by crafting this experience. And I wanted to, that's what I was trying to break away from. That was this big weight that I was wrestling with as a writer that I couldn't find a way free of very easily. And I found it hard to express myself. And so games kind of opened up a whole bunch of doors.
Do you see that path opening up for you now as a designer? I mean, is that way of expressing yourself sort of in your hands as a designer at this point, or is it still something that you feel like we're moving toward?
Well, it's definitely something we're moving towards. I think that's going to be the next 20 or 50 years of what we do. But I mean, for me, again, it's no longer the job of telling the stories. That's not the thing that moves me. It's the creating that universe of chance and things for people to react to so that players don't feel like they're working in the constraining medium that I felt like I was working in when I was trying to write. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about really abstract stuff now. It's really hard to, pin down, but I mean, for me, it's like the creativity, the beauty of games comes from playing them, not from making them. And for me, it's just like, instead of giving people language and the structure of creative writing, I want to give them, I want to give them play and the structure of games so that they can assemble their compelling human narratives in that domain. that's just really super brainy, but there you go.
Well, but that's well, that's why we're here. We're gonna talk about this stuff. Do you has there been a moment, or maybe more than one moment, for you as a designer where you felt that kind of resonance, where you or you've seen a player respond in a way that, that says to you, you know, I'm getting closer, or I've provoked that situation and that kind of response in this player in a way that's meaningful to me as a designer?
It's hard to say because what we're talking about is a response that's so intensely personal, right? I mean, right. it's hard to witness, you know, what's going on inside someone's heart and mind when they're creating. You know, I felt it in myself, and I'm fairly sure that, you know, many of the designers that I've worked with and spoken with have also felt it in themselves. But to speak sort of broadly about the public, it's hard to say. I mean, yeah, I know there are people who try to articulate things that they felt when they were playing, you know, Chaos Theory or playing Far Cry 2 that gives me evidence to believe that the things that they're struggling to try and express about what they love about something that happened to them is the thing that I'm trying to give them. But it's very, you know, I can't even articulate it. How can I expect, you know, Joe Average to articulate it? It's very difficult.
Yeah. But it does seem to me that Far Cry 2 became a kind of focal point for this conversation. And, you know, I wrote about the game, and a lot of us did. And mm-hmm. it more than any other game I've covered or written about, it seemed to me that people responded not so much with like, I liked, you know, the gunplay, or I liked whatever mechanical aspects of the game might have been appealing, but it was more, this is what happened to me in the game. Mm-hmm. These are the stories I have to tell based on playing it. And I've never encountered a game, at least in the 2 years I've been writing the blog, where the conversation that gathers kind of around that game is of that nature.
Yeah, no, I find that particularly fascinating. It's something we picked up on from the very first reviews of the game. Was that was sort of what we were hoping for. But I mean, if you were to take, you know, 20 reviews or 20, you know, blog posts on any top game, Gears of War or Burnout or even GTA, and then take 20 reviews of Far Cry and compare them, I bet you in a game like even GTA, which is really open, I bet you you'll have 3 or 4 out of those 20 reviews or blog posts that will tell some engaging little sort of player-authored story. And if you look at, you know, and Gears will probably be lower than that, but if you look at Far Cry, literally 75 or 80% of those reviews or blog posts give at least one or two paragraphs, sometimes most of the article even, to describing events that happened in the game and why they were exciting and why they were interesting.
Right.
And that's really different from, you know, your typical game experience.
Well, I know you're familiar with Ben Abraham's permanent death sort of experiment with your game. And I find that fascinating, but in the sense that, you know, it's a way of approaching the game that he's kind of altering the experience through his own kind of decision-making, but also it extends the life of the game. I mean, it just seems to me we cover games like What's Hot This Week, and then we drop it and we move on to the next thing. Really, it's very few games out there that we're still talking about months and months and months after they were released.
Yeah, I think there's a small but sort of a small group of people who are sort of fascinated with Far Cry 2, maybe for exactly the reasons I wanted them to be, that are still playing it and still talking about it and still thinking about it, and it's still popping up. You know, at very least as a point of contrast in other discussions. You know, if people will be talking about New Game X or New Game Y, they'll talk about how it's different than Far Cry 2 for some reason, right? And that's interesting to me. That's a sign that we did what we were trying to do correctly.
Yeah. You mentioned after the most recent GDC design workshop that students are getting better and better. That they're arriving sort of well equipped with skills when you meet them.
Yeah.
Do you think we're doing a good job of training young game designers, if training is even the right word?
Yeah. That's very hard to answer. What I can say is that you're doing the job, right? I can't tell whether it's a good job because it would need to have, I mean, because it's being compared against no education, right? But I mean, it's very, very impressive to me. And the question is, like if we're going to see, and we probably will see, improvement over the next decade, right, in the methods of teaching and the things that are being taught and the tools that they're arriving with. I mean, the quality is already astonishing. But like I said, it's being compared to people who are kind of self-taught and making stuff up as they go. So it's already a huge, huge step forward. It's just going to be fascinating to see how much better these students, you know, and sort of new recruits can be in the next decade.
But, you know, if they're interested in making the kinds of games that you're pointing at, it seems to me that they need to have a sense of the world, that they need to have read some books. They need to have a kind of a background that goes beyond just technical skills.
Sure, but that's the same with every field of education, right? Like, it's always good to arrive with technical skills. But I mean, if you people come out of architecture school and have technical skills on how to produce architectural drawings and how to follow building code, but you know, we don't have very many Frank Gehrys in the world, right?
Yeah.
Of course, you need to push yourself, and probably it's only going to come from that, is people who push themselves to experience the world and examine how they feel about things instead of just trying to rely on technical skill. And, you know, that's one of the risks of transitioning from a really DIY, like self-taught sort of industry to an industry of educated craftsmen and professionals is that we could over-focus on technical skill and sort of kind of have the creativity, that sounds lame. I don't mean to break creativity into two different orders, like artist creativity and craftsman creativity. But I mean, like the idea that some of the passion might be kind of overswept by too much focus on technical skill.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's something we'll navigate through. I mean, that's just a natural kind of going to be a natural part of the history of how games come to be what they will be.
Yeah. One last question before we move on to talk about game design. I would describe you in a certain way, and I don't mean this word in a pejorative sense at all, as a kind of an evangelist for game design looking forward and a way of thinking about games that has attracted a certain number of followers. And it's put you in the position of kind of being a spokesperson or you know, an advocate. And I'm wondering if that's, are you comfortable in that role? And did you set out to do that, or has it just sort of happened?
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't set out to do it. I mean, I really feel like I'm just saying the things that the designers that I've always, you know, respected and admired and tried to emulate were saying before me, right? You know, guys like Doug Church and Harvey Smith, these guys are, they really gave me the perspectives that I put into practice. And, you know, just for whatever reason, you know, with the success of Splinter Cell, you know, it kind of put me, put a little bit of a spotlight on me when those guys didn't have the good fortune of having the huge media attention on their games at in that same window. So, I mean, kind of fell on me a little bit. Mm-hmm. I am very, very concerned with how the medium develops, and I see that there's a lot of different ways that it can go. And I look at the future of it and think, you know, if I don't stand up and say these things that I think are really important to me and rally these people behind me and get them to think about them too, I'm a little bit afraid of what the future could hold if we don't sort of stick a flag in the ground and rally around it.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if you've met with resistance from, you know, members of your own peer group among other designers to your ideas, like resistance to sort of where you're trying to pull us.
Well, I mean, to some extent, yeah. I mean, I think that there are people out there who are very, very content in just making, you know, straightforward entertainment. They're very, very content to just say, like, what players want is like bigger explosions and bigger guns and bounce your boobs and. They just want to make fun, entertaining, consumable games, and they don't really want to think, or they don't necessarily see any value in thinking about you know, the development of the medium and the future of the medium and the importance of the legacy that we build into the medium and leave for the people who follow us in a few decades. And you know, I happen to think that that's really important, and it's. You know, it's perfectly okay to not think that, but I just want to make sure that we don't all end up not thinking about the future of the medium, and that we don't all just bigger guns and bigger explosions. To me, and that's my personal bias, that feels like a bit of a race to the bottom, and I want to make sure that we at least protect the ability of our medium to say things that are more than just boom for the future.
Yeah. Well, let's transition into a little chat about some of the issues you've been exploring, especially recently online on your blog and on Twitter and various other places. And for that, I'm going to invite Borut Pfeiffer and Manveer Hair. If you'll give me a moment, Clint, we'll have to reconnect because I need to set up a conference call. So we'll hang up and then I'll bring them in and you'll be with us.
Sweet.
Cool. So I want to welcome Manveer Hair and Borut Pfeiffer to this conversation with Clint Hocking. Borut is a game developer at EA LA, where he works as a lead AI programmer. He has also worked at Radical and at Sony Online and at his own startup called White Knuckle Games. And he's taught at the Vancouver Film School's game design program. So welcome, Borut.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you back. He's back for me. He's not back for my audience because we had a technical problem the last time we recorded together. And so you didn't get to hear him because that program was never recorded. But this one is being recorded, I promise. Man, Borut, I promise it's being recorded.
Sure. We'll see.
Manveer Hair is a lead designer at Raven Software on an unannounced game. This is is it okay if I say this? The recent promotion, Manveer?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is big, big news. Big congratulations. Promoted to lead designer at Raven Software.
Thank you very much.
Congrats, Manveer.
Thank you.
We can't discuss the game, of course, and I know Clint's working on a game we can't discuss. And Borut, are you working on something we can't discuss?
Actually, I will be leaving EALA next week, so I will not be working on anything shortly.
Okay. All right. Manveer also recently worked as a designer on the now finished Wolfenstein.
Not necessarily finished, but it'll be out on August 18th, so it's right about there,
Okay. Well, good luck with that, and like we said, release date August 18th. I wanted to bring the three of you together because I've been intrigued by the conversation that you've been having online, provoked in some ways by a presentation that Manveer made at the Games Learning and Society conference about ethical gameplay. Clint responded to that in an interesting way on his blog, and I'll link to that when I release the podcast. But I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about how designers think about meaningful, emotionally engaging games and how we get there. And I think what interested me about the small debate that Manveer and Clint had was that it was clearly two different ways of thinking about it. So Manveer, if I could, if you could just in a kind of thumbnail sketch way, give me a sense of how you see a designer's role in designing, in this case, something that would impart a kind of ethical system or an ethical dimension to games. And then we'll kind of start from there.
Sure. So my view is that the designer's role is to kind of pose questions to the player. Not necessarily pose their own sense of ethical morality, ethics or morality, and say this is the right way to think, but rather let the player experience something and let them come to their own conclusions. And we really don't do that very often enough in our games, I feel like. So in my talk of designing ethical dilemmas, I kind of narrowed down ways to increase the chances of basically making a better ethical dilemma in a game. And I broke it down to you have to have some narrative in there, so your player needs to care about the world. You need to have consequences for the choice that you actually have to make. It can't just be something that you can change later if you do something else for a different person. You want to put some obstacles in the way. So basically make the decision harder. You can make a decision harder by, kind of pushing them towards one way, which might be the way you think most of your audience is not going to want to choose. And the final piece of it, which is the one that caused some contention, was this concept of permanence. Now, what I meant by permanence wasn't that like you can't reload a save game ever or you can't redo parts of the game, but rather I was almost thinking of, hey, maybe we're designing a game and we point out five ethical dilemmas in the game as designers. Basically, once the player makes that decision in the game, that they can't redo that specific decision. They could reload an earlier save, but if they got to that point again, like the decision would just be made automatically. And basically make the player stick with the decisions that they've made, and that will hopefully have some more impact and create more meaning through that mechanic.
So, Manver, am I correct in describing this as really a question about authorship, about the role of the designer as an author or authoring the experience of the player?
Yeah, I think to an extent it definitely it is about authorship. Like how much of myself do I impart in the game and let the gamer, the player experience is what it comes down to, right? Yeah. Like, do I just take them on a narrative, linear path and go have the ups and downs exactly where I want them? Or do I let it be free form and, more like The Sims and let just the player play in the sandbox or somewhere in between?
Clint, you have a different point of view about this, obviously.
Well, I mean, to be clear, I think that Manveer and I, we don't disagree on any fundamental level, right, in terms of this conversation. I think that we agree, and it's just a question of certain fine points and certain, I don't want to be too pedantic about it, but very, very subtle nuances of what the things that he said, how they can be interpreted and what they mean. For me, the real question is, I think we both agree we don't want our games to be preachy. We don't want to be saying, you have to help old ladies cross the street. Like, I don't think we're trying to teach people how to live their lives. I think we're trying to give them an experience that's going to be meaningful and resonant with them. I think the point at which we maybe disagree a little bit is in the intensity with which we are willing to leverage the sort of the narrative tools and impose a certain amount of our own authorship onto the play experience. To sort of say it as simply as possible, like the way I see what Manveer describes, while it's very, very cool and I would be very, very happy to play more games like this, I think it converges inevitably towards games that are a lot like the movies that we have today. And for me, I'm looking for something that's fundamentally different than that. And I think that games are a fundamentally different medium than film or novels or any sort of linear authored medium. And I think that the best way to make things that are the most meaningful and resonant for players is to use the tools that are unique to our medium and kind of try to steer as widely around the sort of more traditional tools. It's really just a question of degree and a question of what we're capable of. Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, it's a really, really fine point, I think, that we're debating.
Yeah. Borut, did you want to jump in?
I totally think Clint's right in the sense that at a fundamental level, we kind of agree and the kind of experiences we'd like to create. And just, exactly, it's a finer point of the methods. For me, I think where I diverge from Clint is the distinction between like ludic tools and narrative tools and trying to, find tools that are really both and exploring how systems can kind of convey or put a person into a role. Obviously some games, let you like create your character, and some games tell you play Bill Smith. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how you interact with the system actually like puts you into a certain mindset and wants you to take on a certain role. And that's one, kind of one method of that I'm most interested in exploring, how to kind of give these types of experiences.
Yeah. Is there a game that you could cite that does in a systems kind of way get close to that?
That's the thing. There's not a whole lot. You could say a lot of games do this on a very superficial level. I mean, they make you a killing machine and what you do is kill, but that's not quite what I'm talking about. I mean, the most like iconic example of this in my mind is something like, you know, it's not necessarily like a good, it's kind of an evil example, at the Stanford Prison Experiment, you know, where basically all the students taking part in the experiment were meant to do is basically take on this rule set. You know, some are prisoners, some are guards. The guards had these, you know, like 10 or so rules that the prisoners had to follow, and how they're, you know, being put into that system made them lose their own identity and then take on the identity of, you know, prisoners and guards and what they, you know, did to each other because of that. So that's like the strongest like possible example in real life, not so much, you know, a game. I mean, it was a system, but you know, that is to me, like it's an example of like how powerful like systems can really be to affect a person and potentially in a bad way. So there's a lot of like responsibility there we have as designers.
You mentioned Bill Smith, the character.
Right.
Who is Bill Smith? This is what I'm curious about, and maybe this is just my theater background, but I'm fascinated by the player's relationship to the character, and you know who is the character? The character is Bill Smith, the player. Is Bill Smith some sort of composite of various things? What is the relationship of the player to the character, in your view, in an ideal way? How should that work, Clint?
Well, I mean, that's a question that I thought a lot about on working on Splinter Cell in particular, because you have a very strong character with a very pronounced, you know, personality. And then you have, obviously, the player who can literally can be anyone. And the question is, how do you create an experience that's resonant and that allows the experience of being Sam Fisher to make you feel like you and Sam Fisher are sort of this hybrid entity that is someone that is compelling to you, even if Sam is very different from you, or even if you don't identify with him. It's definitely a different way of thinking about it. About what a character is. And, you know, this is what I'm talking about, it goes back to what I'm talking about sort of trying to leverage, you know, the ludic tools to their greatest extent. Like, it's recognizing this disconnect between player and avatar and the sort of, for lack of a better word, the sort of synergies that can arise out of the two being synchronized or desynchronized, and trying to make the player feel more and interesting in different things through that. That's a real important challenge in game design, in my opinion. And, you know, I think we, you know, specifically in the writing of Sam's character, and specifically in, you know, tracking, you know, when I was writing Chaos Theory, keeping track of some of the events that happen over the course of the game and keeping track of some of the decisions that the player makes and using those to alter some of Sam's dialogue and some of the things he says in some of the scenes, depending on the actions that you take in the immediate. You're sort of attempting to detect what the player's doing and at different scales and reflect that back to him when Sam does certain actions that you're also detecting to try and make something that's resonates more deeply. And that's something that you really can't do in any other medium, because obviously there's no such thing as feedback in other media. So, I mean, it's a very, very interesting question. And I think the future of it is not in making more compelling characters who are more compellingly written. I think the future of it is making more compelling characters who are more compellingly interactive, and who can, and then the design work lies in figuring out how to detect player action and reflect that through the character, so that there's interesting aggregate personality stuff happening that is meaningful.
Now, no matter what happens here, though, we're going to have to at some point kind of, I mean, it's really this shared authorship idea, right? Like with the player that, hey, we have all these branches that we are creating. And as you input into the system, we're going to go down different versions of these branches and give you that. And that's going to feel like your version of the game. And maybe that version of the game isn't the exact same that somebody else plays, which I think is really awesome. Like, I mean, Fallout 3 to me was that kind of game where I have conversations at work with people who played the game, and we had very different experiences, and that's really exciting. But at the end of the day, what Clint's talking about here is still a high level of authorship in the system. It's just lots of different authored pieces that the player can choose without even knowing that he's choosing them.
So in this way, I mean, even the environment itself is authorship.
Well, yeah, of course it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Just indirect versus like direct or linear.
Right. But to what degree, and maybe Borat, you can speak to this, to what degree is AI a kind of pivotal factor here?
Well, it depends. It depends what you put under the realm of AI. I mean, there's a lot of, I think in terms of the storytelling, there's a lot we could be doing in terms of how we author our stories. And that kind of, you know, slightly veers into the realm of AI in terms of like how we set up the story elements, you know, in our story webs, instead of like, you know, explicitly linking each element. So we create all the chains for the player that he could possibly go through. Instead, we author the nodes, you know, basically saying this story node just has these requirements. And then these other story nodes have these effects. And together, the player can basically create his own web. I mean, we do constrain it, but the thing is, by doing that, you kind of open up the player to potentially create paths you didn't foresee, but at the same time, you know, follow the same narrative requirements. So that could be considered AI. It certainly uses like techniques from AI, like planning and search. And, you know, I mean, obviously there's more on, you know, just the character side of, you know, making characters more interactive and, you know, more believable. And that's certainly AI, but it falls under that kind of those two areas.
I think you could probably look at the Left 4 Dead AI director as well, that just kind of, it tries to figure out, like some designers probably made a graph that's the pacing of the game, right? And it's just trying to spawn and send AI your way to match that pacing graph. I mean, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying the system completely, but like, that's a great way, I think, to leverage AI in terms of getting towards the emotions that you want the player to feel, in this case, you know, fear.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the barriers to going forward, in your view, from a designer's point of view? Are they technological? Are they limits of imagination and creativity, a mix of both?
One thing I'll say is I really don't believe that the technology is the barrier. I think that we have for a long time had the technology to do the kinds of things that we need to do. Like the stuff that Borat is describing is, it's just not, I just don't see it as being as technically any more difficult than pathfinding or ray tracing or any of a number of other sort of technical challenges that we have to deal with. It's just that we don't, it's much, much harder to think about it for designers maybe, and for programmers as well. Like finding your way around some boxes in a room is a very concrete problem. Finding your way through story nodes in order to output something that's more or less meaningful is a lot more abstract. So I don't think it's a technical problem. I think it's us trying to understand how character develops, how meaning is developed, how investment and agency are developed through systems. These are very, very difficult abstract problems. And then on top of that, I think there are the other biggest challenges, just a business imperative challenge, which is that, and one of the reasons that I kind of take a stand against taking the sort of easy advanced narrative approach and having better cutscenes and better, you know, authored narratives to make players cry more predictably is simply because those things are provably going to be, those are something we can improve very easily and very obviously, and they converge our medium towards being a lot more like film rapidly, and they put a lot more risk on developers and publishers and designers who want to do something more or do something less authored and more systemic and more dynamic, because it's going to take us a lot longer to figure out our problems. And so we're going to kind of be behind the leading edge of the wave, and that's going to be hard for us to be profitable, and it's going to be a disincentive for people to put money into that future. So the two biggest challenges are design and business. I don't think the technology challenge is tremendously difficult.
To what degree are players themselves a barrier?
They fall under the business challenge sort of part, in the sense that if I'm a player and I have a choice between a game that is, as you know, a boxing game that is as deeply moving as Rocky and a boxing game that is not, it's very hard for players to invest with their dollars in the future of a medium, right? That's not what they're doing when they make a purchase, right? They're investing with their dollars in their entertainment over the next 10 hours or 20 hours or 40 hours, right? And they shouldn't really you know, in capitalist society, be expected to be investing their dollars in the future of an entertainment medium. That's not, you know, that's not what that's not what money is for. So I mean, are they a problem? No, they're kind of the reality check, right? They're kind of the anchor. But I mean, and you know, going back to your original questions about why I end up being vocal about this stuff, it's because if you let that anchor hit the bottom, it's going to be a lot harder to go forward. So you have to drag it and keep it from falling, or else it's going to be a lot harder to go forward in the future.
And I think that the problem with players is also one of perception. So I've been fortunate or unfortunate enough to like have been in focus tests before, where you present an idea to players, or you ask them what they want to see in like the game you're working on. And inevitably, when you do this, all you're going to get is the regurgitation of whatever the last five features were of the game they like really loved, right? Yeah. You know, they're going to tell me that they want, like, you know, levels like Call of Duty 4 for their multiplayer, and they want, like, a really cool nuke sequence and realistic weapons. And they're just going to tell you whatever they've played. So it's really up to us as designers and creatives to come up with the next level of what players want and sell it to them. And once they've experienced that, then they're going to go out and ask for it again. You know, if we're able to hit this and do it well, and what Clint's talking about, and someone experiences it, they're going to start looking for that in their games. And then slowly the market will start to shift that way. And we can actually start making this a viable, you know, business model for sustaining, instead of saying every game needs to be a cinematic masterpiece. You know, instead of doing this whole, what I disagreed with of like Dennis Dyack's little talk about the narrative being more important than gameplay.
Borat, I know you've with your own startup, have been working towards a way of thinking about games that takes into account things like social responsibility and games that have that aren't empty experiences that create meaningful, kind of thoughtful, provocative moments for players. I guess the question I have about that is there an audience for it?
I think there is. I mean, just if you look at the indie game space, you know, I mean, I think there's a set of people who are, you know, a part of the audience who are hungry for new experiences or for anything that's slightly different. The problem is the constraints, you know, then applies of like, okay, the size of that audience is still like small enough that, you know, the amount of money you have a limited amount of time and money to spend to make your game successful. And so your scope, even if you do something like interesting in the scope of like, you know, narrative, you have to, you know, be very, very focused. And so, and the problem is, I mean, like, you know, I agree with Clint that it's, you know, it's a design problem in the sense that people, it's a difficult thing to do. And, you don't necessarily see people, you know, experimenting with it, even in the indie game space, which always kind of frustrates me. But yeah, that's kind of the reality. I think there is a space where you could be successful. It's just really small at the moment. Like, you'd have to really constrain your game and be very, you know, particular about it. But you could, you know, be successful if you're also like, you know, if you did 100 other things right as well.
Yeah. How seriously does a person... One of my colleagues, for example, an English professor, let's say, who's interested in the potential of games to create these kinds of experiences, you know, he looks at my computer screen or whatever I'm playing, and he sees me as basically a guy with a gun. That I am a gun, basically. I don't even exist. I am a gun. I'm navigating through this world as a gun. I mean, to what degree is that really a barrier as well? Just the fact that even a game as ambitious as Far Cry 2 is essentially a game where I'm a gun.
There is enough people who play those kind of games that still want something new and interesting that, you know, I mean, that's still enough, but certainly to expand the scope even more, you know, to remove that type of context would, you know, help immensely.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're falling in, as an industry, in some sense, falling into a trap of thinking, look how much the industry is growing. Look how much more people, how many more people are playing games. Look how much, you know, more, you know, units, Call of Duty is selling and GTA is selling and Halo is selling. And I think that there's this risk of saying, you know, what everybody wants is blockbusters. What everybody wants is Batman, whatever, you know, the movie. What everybody wants is Transformers. What everybody wants is these AAA sort of action blockbusters, which sort of almost inevitably involve a guy with a gun, right? And so we want to make those games. The problem is, and the thing I think that we're being a little bit nearsighted about as an industry, is the fact that, you know, the tremendous, you know, billions of dollars of success of, you know, Batman Dark Knight, or you know, whatever this year's biggest, you know, money earner in the film box office is built out of the fact that the Hollywood movie industry is really a mass market industry, right? Everybody goes to movies. And Batman, you know, finds a way to get everybody who might not actually be all that interested in, you know, Guy with a Gun or whatever, to say, you know, I'll take a chance on this movie. You know, like, you know, normally I like On Golden Pond and, like, you know, movies about, you know, housewives and people with who are terminally ill or whatever the hell. And but they decide they're going to go see Batman, you know, because it's, you know, one or two times a year they'll go see something that's the big blockbuster of the summer, and they'll still enjoy it because it's entertainment and it's still well crafted. But the point is, we haven't built that mass market audience, right? We haven't built an audience of people who play games, who play, you know, 8 games a year, and then will also play Halo. We only have an audience built out of all the people who go to the blockbuster. And so our audience is, like, you know, 1/10 or 1% of the size that it could potentially be. And because it's growing, simply because I think, you know, Generation Y is a lot bigger than Generation X, simply because that audience is growing, no one's questioning about whether we should be broadening the market to make games about terminally ill people and On Golden Pond or whatever the game. I think to some extent that's what the Wii is doing. I think to some extent that's what certain, you know, DS games are doing. And most importantly, I think that's maybe what indie games are doing. You know, they're finding new audiences and people who maybe have become a little disenfranchised with the AAA action blockbuster game space. And we're finding new ways to hold on to these people. But that, in my mind, is where the real growth and the real future of the industry is in nurturing that base, so that we can one day have blockbusters that aren't necessarily exclusively about the guy with the gun.
One of the things that I think is holding us back from also expanding the audience to go along with what Clint's saying is, you know, we're still in this model of 8 to 20 hour games that cost $60. And I think just that alone is a barrier that a lot of people aren't willing to get their heads around. You know, but the hardcore community wants more and more and more gameplay. So we keep ratcheting up and saying, okay, we're going to give you 30, 40 hours of gameplay in this game. You're going to be able to do all of this. But really, who's getting to the end of this stuff? To me, one of the most impactful games of people who, like, that don't really play games but heard about it was Portal, because I know so many people who actually beat and got all the way through Portal and experienced it as a whole. So I guess that becomes a question of, is it okay to experience – well, it's okay to experience games as a part, but are we getting the full amount out of the games that necessarily Clinton, Baruton, and myself are putting into the games when you only experience a quarter or a half of it? And should we change that side of the model to closer match what the audience really seems like they want? Shorter dev cycles, shorter games.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is, if, you know, say a game is 40 hours long, if you think that, you know, only 10% or 20% of players actually play the last hour of the game, like, you know, that means that, say it's 20%, you know, that means the last hour of the game literally costs 5 times as much as the first hour of the game. And that's you know, once you grab that out and start, you know, plugging in the $20 million, $30 million, $40 million budgets of modern AAA games and looking at games that are 20, 30, 40 hours long, where 10% of people are playing the last 10 hours, I find it a bit astonishing that the business case isn't being made, like, yeah, there are a few 100,000 people complaining that our games are too short when they're 60 hours long. But, you know, we got to stop listening to those people, I think, at some point.
And the other thing is, you know, what do we, you know, if I have two critical problems in a game, and one's in the second level and one's in the second to last level, which one do you think I'm going to fix?
Absolutely.
Right? I'm going to fix the one in the second level. And so all I'm doing is reinforcing the fact that the second half of the game isn't as good as the first half.
Right.
So less people are likely to play it. So then we get into this weird cycle of just doing this over and over.
Yeah.
What if we flip this around to my point of view as a game critic, which I've only recently started even thinking of myself in that way. What role does games criticism have to play, if any, in this evolution?
I mean, they're definitely, like, you know, a big proponent of it. I mean, and, you know, the more, you know, people that are writing about it, and the more people such as yourself that, you know, write about it well and are, you know, have some like reach and audience, you know, and then that, you know, gets picked up by more mainstream media, you know, and business, you know, game execs can see, you know, articles about like, oh, you know, maybe these games are too long. You know, any little bit like helps.
Yeah, I think the same thing. I mean, I think that criticism obviously plays an important role in describing the sort of cultural influence of a game so that business people can understand what's going on with their product. I think we've, in the game industry, literally until 3 or 4 years ago, we didn't have criticism. We had reviews, and we really didn't understand the difference. And now that we're starting to, now that we're starting to see criticism, coming from lots of different directions, you know, we're starting to see, games being discussed in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and obviously on all of the blogs and websites that are definitely more critical than review focused. I think it's gonna, it's maybe not happening as much as I would personally like yet, but I think in the next, 5 years, we're going to see as big a change in criticism as, and its effects and powers, as we've seen in the last five. And that's pretty exciting to me because I think it will have some pretty far reaching impacts on what we're going to be allowed to do.
Do you guys think it's necessary for our industry to develop a critic that kind of has his own sense of personality? Roger Ebert lives outside of his criticism, right? He's become kind of bigger than the body of his work, just the object of him. Music's got reviewers or critics like that as well. Do you think that our industry also needs to have someone like that, you know, that becomes this kind of vocal like point that everyone looks at for the main set of criticism to kind of break through to the rest of the audience or potential audience?
I think we already kind of have that. I think Yahtzee is, I mean, maybe kind of a light version of that, and still kind of more, I don't want to say review focused, but more focused on the audience of people who read reviews. But definitely he's defining himself as much through his style and his form, and his personality, as through anything else. And I think that's inevitable. I don't think we need to actively nurture that. I think it's going to happen. There's going to be sort of a rise out of the growing breadth of critics out there. There's going to be a few that will set themselves apart based on formal qualities.
I think it's tough. You know, you look at how old media has tried to make the transition into this online space and how difficult it's been. You know, the New York Times assumes that they can sort of bring their kind of cachet with them, and it's all just going to be, you know, just like it was in the old world. And really, they're just another site. Maybe they're a terrific site, and maybe they've got better reporters than some. But ultimately, it's just another destination for people to go to. And I was curious in particular regarding games criticism about the Crispy Gamers site, which is a collection of writers that I admire a lot and that I've followed when they weren't part of that group, and they became sort of a hub, I guess, for games criticism that was created to sort of drive traffic towards those writers. And to take nothing away from what they do, because I think they're really, really good, it hasn't turned out to be the central place for games criticism that I think maybe they might have thought it would. Even gathering those kinds of really articulate critics together and reviewers, there's still just so many other places out there to go, and people find kind of what they want to read or the person they prefer to read, that it's hard to find a place that has that much gravity.
Yeah. Case in point, I don't actually read Crispy Gamers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or do I?
Yeah. But it was interesting because when they started it, it was very clear that this was to be the collection of game cognoscenti, you know, that this was the best and the brightest of the writers all in one place.
I don't think you can just go and self-proclaim that, though. You got to earn that. Right. I mean, even if they've all earned it individually, you just can't get, you know, the three of us can't just go start a studio and say, hey, this is going to be the greatest game studio of all time. The next game we make is going to be amazing, right? We have to sit there and design that game and then present it to you and convince you that this is going to blow your socks off and this is the game you want to buy.
Yeah, I mean that's the challenge, is how do they stand up against the New York Times, who maybe doesn't have maybe they don't have the great writers and the great hub of game criticism that you say that Crispy Gamer maybe does, but I mean, they are the New York Times. They've earned their stripes and they've demonstrated to the world that they have the best critics in the world. So why would that not apply to games? So there's a, so you're right. Well, the New York Times is maybe losing ground in its, in the sort of modern world where you can go to any old site you want and pick any old favorite you want. It's also still just because of their sheer weight over the last century. It's going to be hard for a new group of critics to kind of depose the king, I think.
But in some sense, it's a problem. I mean, just on any, you know, whether you're marketing an indie game and, you know, or you're a critic and you're, you know, trying to, in a sense, market your work, you know, the space, all those spaces are crowded and, you know, we're going to have to find new strategies as well just to, you know, reach more people. So, you know, that's a constraint. Just one more constraint to, towards making. <talking about.
laughs> Oh, good to know we found the last one, though.
That's good. Right.
I've been writing them down. After all of it. We're good.
If you don't mind, I want to ask you all just one more question. When I went to GDC this last time, and I was there before, and I'll sort of direct this to you, Clint, but then we'll kind of spread it out between Manvir and Borat. You know, you're a very public person. I happen to be sitting behind you at one of the events, and you have this sort of steady stream of traffic over to you and people chatting with you, people know you. And these are, you know, game writers, academics, game studies people, other designers. And, you know, you've got the blog and you do these public speeches and you're, you know, here we are, you're chatting with me. I'm curious to know what's in that for you. Beyond just, you know, kind of touchy-feely, you know, I like to talk to people and that sort of thing. Right. What comes back for you there? And I know, Manvir, you were at GLS, you very publicly presented it there, and Boris, you've been writing that blog very regularly for quite a while. What's in this for you guys?
Oh, I mean, for me, I just like to be, I mean, GDC is a special thing, right? It's not me... teaching. It's a conference of my peers, right? I don't like to think of it as being, you know, I'm a public person and there's all of the fans who come to talk to me. I mean, to me, every game developer is my peer. And I don't want to create some kind of illusion that of importance, right? I want to be, and it's the same on my team. I don't try to sit in an office and tell people what to do. I work on the floor in the design pit, you know, sitting with all the other guys on my team. I don't like the world, and it's the same with my games too. I don't want to be the designer lording it over all the players. I like to be part of the ground. I like to be down in the trenches with the guys, whether they're the developers at GDC, whether they're the people reading my blog. You know, I like to hang out in the comments section on my blog and other people's blogs and share my ideas there. I don't believe in top down. I believe in aggregate bottom up. And you know, I don't just say that. You know, that's what I actually believe. That's where I'm happy and that's where I'm comfortable. It's where I like to work. And it's where I've had the most success. So I mean, I'm not gonna try and change that because I prefer it.
Have you been challenged by that environment? When you go to GDC, do you leave there with sort of a head full of ideas?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, maybe there's a lot of attention on my talks or whatever, but I mean, I still take away a lot more from the questions that I get on my talk and from, you know, sitting in the audience of other people's talks than I think anybody gets away from me. That's for sure. I mean, there's so many smart people and, you know, year after year, there's more and more and more of them. And it's becoming really even more exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Borat?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a little different. You know, the games that I've worked on that have shipped haven't exactly, you know, don't exactly represent my design philosophy. And, you know, in the past couple of years, I've been working on something cool, but it hasn't, you know, it's been shut down. So it's like, for me, the blog was, you know, mainly a way of just like, you know, documenting what, you know, my own like personal design style, that kind of thing. And it's had really cool, you know, side effects. I mean, well, from that original goal, I mean, now they're, you know, they have become more of the goal for me. Just like, you know, that's a way of like having people like find you and talk to you and have interesting conversations. And that's really cool. And people can, I mean, you know, I was sitting down with someone dinner last week in the indie game space about potentially helping them out, and primarily just because of the blog. Like, you know, they knew that they read the blog and thought it was really cool. So all those kind of conversations that come about from it are definitely the driving like purpose. But that said, you know, I do think there is a benefit to the industry as a whole to have more, you know, designers and whatnot that have more public profiles, you know, so Cliffy B gets, you know, an article in the New Yorker, you know, good for him. And in an odd way, perhaps, you know, in a roundabout way, perhaps good for all of us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I know what you're saying, Clint, about you're not in, you don't intend to sort of celebrate your celebrity or whatever, but I do think that there is something positive about having people who do have a kind of status like that, that it's exciting. People get excited to hear them, and it creates, you know, you have a certain authority that you might not otherwise have. And, you know, there's definitely an upside to the celebrity thing, I guess I would suggest.
Sure, there's nothing wrong with having it, but I think that the upside of celebrity is magnified a thousandfold when you have a conversation with someone over a drink in the bar who thinks you're a celebrity, and then they realize that they're in fact just like you.
Yeah.
Because then you make them realize that celebrity isn't important. You make them realize that in fact they can do everything that you've done. They can be all the things that they think that you are. They've imbued you with this kind of mystical idea of what you are, and when you dispel it, you empower them greatly. And that's what I, you know, that's the same thing I mean when I talk about my games. I try to dispel the notion that it's the game that is driving this experience and make the player realize that it's him who's the star and him who can do all of these wonderful things. I mean, it's the same concept.
That sounds like a teacher to me. I just want to quickly mention before you answer the question, Manveer, you know, you presented at the Games Learning and Society Conference up there in Madison, and you worked very, very hard on that presentation. I know you did, and that meant a lot to you. You invested a terrific amount of passion, I think, into what you were up to, and, you know, you were pulled away from Wolfenstein. You were extremely busy at the time. Why?
I think it's kind of a mix of what these two guys are talking about. One is... giving these conversations, these are all conversations. They're never lectures. They're never talks. They're conversations. It's just, you know, I'm in front of you giving my point of view, and then later we have the rest of the conversation, whether it be online or at a bar or in person, just, you know, right in the hallways. So for me, that conversation is important. It was really important when Clint, you know, gave me criticism back on my talk, because I want and need that. That's going to make me better. Even if I don't 100% agree with it, you know, he's opened my eyes up to some paths I hadn't fully thought about, or I hadn't realized that I agree with. And it was like, oh yeah, that does make sense. I just hadn't been able to put it in words that way. So for me, I'm a young designer. I'm only 4 years into this industry. These guys have been in the industry a lot longer than I have. So my job is to be a sponge and learn everything I can from the people who have been here before me, and then also bring my own kind of unique take on it and hopefully help advance the entire, you know, medium as a whole by the time I, you know, leave. Hmm. So those conversations are the only way that's going to happen. The blog is just a great way to also continue these conversations with you guys, and Twitter's another thing that people are using that starts these conversations going over and over. So for me, what I'm getting out of it is I'm learning. I'm getting better. I'm understanding the world better. I'm getting different points of view. And hopefully I'm able to wrap all that knowledge and put it into the next title or the next design that I help work on. And, you know, that plus everybody else's collaborations on the team will hopefully make something very unique that the market wants and that's, you know, significant.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining me and for spending time on a Sunday talking with me. And I just can't tell you how much it means to me to have these conversations. I can't wait to put the podcast out. So Manveer Hare, Clint Hocking, Borut Pfeiffer, thank you all three of you for joining me. And I hope we can do this again some other time.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Michael. That was great.
Okay, cool. Take care, guys.
Take it easy.